Chrome Yellow by Aldous Huxley, read for LibriVox.org by Martin Clifton. Chapter 22. For the sake of peace and quiet, Denis had returned earlier on this same afternoon to his bedroom. He wanted to work, but the hour was a drowsy one, and lunch, so recently eaten, weighed heavily on body and mind. The meridian demon was upon him. He was possessed by that bored and hopeless post-prandial melancholy which the Coenobites of old knew and feared under the name of acidie. He felt, like Ernest Dowson, a little weary. He was in the mood to write something rather exquisite and gentle, and quietest in tone. Something a little droopy, and at the same time, how should he put it, a little infinite. He thought of Anne, of love hopeless and unattainable. Perhaps that was the ideal kind of love, the hopeless kind, the quiet, theoretical kind of love. In this sad mood of repletion, he could well believe it. He began to write. An elegant quatrain had flowed from beneath his pen. A brooding love which is, at most, the stealth of moonbeams when they slide, evoking colour's bloodless ghost o'er some scarce-breathing breast or side, when his attention was attracted by a sound from outside. He looked down from his window. There they were, Anne and Gombauld, talking, laughing together. They crossed the courtyard in front and passed out of sight through the gate in the right-hand wall. That was the way to the green close and the granary. She was going to sit for him again. His pleasantly depressing melancholy was dissipated by a puff of violent emotion. Angrily he threw his quatrain into the waste-paper basket and ran downstairs. The stealth of moonbeams, indeed! In the hall he saw Mr. Scogan. The man seemed to be lying in wait. Denis tried to escape, but in vain. Mr. Scogan's eye glittered like the eye of the Ancient Mariner. "Not so fast," he said, stretching out a small saurian hand with pointed nails. "Not so fast. I was just going down to the flower garden to take the sun. We'll go together." Denis abandoned himself. Mr. Scogan put on his hat, and they went out arm in arm. On the shaven turf of the terrace, Henry Wimbush and Mary were playing a solemn game of bowls. They descended by the yew-tree walk. It was here, thought Denis, here that Anne had fallen, here that he had kissed her, here, and he blushed with retrospective shame at the memory, here that he had tried to carry her and failed. Life was awful. "Sanity," said Mr. Scogan, suddenly breaking a long silence. "Sanity, that's what's wrong with me, and that's what will be wrong with you, my dear Denis, when you're old enough to be sane or insane. In a sane world, I should be a great man. As things are in this curious establishment, I am nothing at all. To all intents and purposes, I don't exist. I am just vox et praeterea nihil." Denis made no response. He was thinking of other things. "After all," he said to himself, "after all, Gombauld is better looking than I, more entertaining, more confident, and besides, he's already somebody, and I'm still only potential." "Everything that gets done in this world is done by madmen," Mr. Scogan went on. Denis tried not to listen, but the tireless insistence of Mr. Scogan's discourse gradually compelled his attention. "Men such as I am, such as you may possibly become, have never achieved anything. We're too sane, we're merely reasonable. We lack the human touch, the compelling, enthusiastic mania. People are quite ready to listen to the philosophers for a little amusement, just as they would listen to a fiddler or a mountebank. But as to acting on the advice of the man of reason, never. Whenever the choice has had to be made between the man of reason and the madman, the world has unhesitatingly followed the madman. For the madman appeals to what is fundamental, to passion and the instincts. The philosophers to what is superficial and supererogatory, reason. They enter the garden. At the head of one of the alleys stood a green wooden bench, embayed in the midst of a fragrant continent of lavender bushes. It was here, though the place was shadeless and one breathed hot, dry perfume instead of air, it was here that Mr. Scogan elected to sit. He thrived on untempered sunlight. Consider, for example, the case of Luther and Erasmus. He took out his pipe and began to fill it as he talked. There was Erasmus, a man of reason if ever there was one. People listened to him at first. A new virtuoso, performing on that elegant and resourceful instrument, the intellect. They even admired and venerated him. But did he move them to behave as he wanted them to behave, reasonably, decently, or at least a little less porkishly than usual? He did not. And then Luther appears, violent, passionate, a madman, insanely convinced about matters in which there can be no conviction. He shouted, and men rushed to follow him. Erasmus was no longer listened to. He was reviled for his reasonableness. Luther was serious. Luther was reality, like the Great War. Erasmus was only reason and decency. He lacked the power, being a sage, to move men to action. Europe followed Luther and embarked on a century and a half of war and bloody persecution. It's a melancholy story. Mr. Scogan lighted a match. In the intense light, the flame was all but invisible. The smell of burning tobacco began to mingle with the sweetly acrid smell of the lavender. If you want to get man to act reasonably, you must set about persuading them in a maniacal manner. The very sane precepts of the founders of religions are only made infectious by means of enthusiasms which to a sane man must appear deplorable. It is humiliating to find how impotent unadulterated sanity is. Sanity, for example, informs us that the only way in which we can preserve civilization is by behaving decently and intelligently. Sanity appeals and argues. Our rulers persevere in their customary porkishness while we acquiesce and obey. The only hope is a maniacal crusade. I am ready, when it comes, to beat a tambourine with the loudest, but at the same time I shall feel a little ashamed of myself. However, Mr. Scogan shrugged his shoulders and, pipe in hand, made a gesture of resignation. It's futile to complain that things are as they are. The fact remains that sanity, unassisted, is useless. What we want, then, is a sane and reasonable exploitation of the forces of insanity. We sane men will have the power yet. Mr. Scogan's eyes shone with a more than ordinary brightness, and, taking his pipe out of his mouth, he gave vent to his loud, dry, and somehow rather fiendish laugh. "But I don't want power," said Denis. He was sitting in limp discomfort at one end of the bench, shading his eyes from the intolerable light. Mr. Scogan, bolt upright at the other end, laughed again. "Everybody wants power," he said, "power in some form or other. The sort of power you hanker for is literary power. Some people want power to persecute other human beings. You expend your lust for power in persecuting words, twisting them, moulding them, torturing them to obey you. But I divagate." "Do you?" asked Denis faintly. "Yes," Mr. Scogan continued, unheeding. "The time will come, we men of intelligence will learn to harness the insanities to the service of reason. We can't leave the world any longer to the direction of chance. We can't allow dangerous maniacs like Luther, mad about dogma, like Napoleon, mad about himself, to go on casually appearing and turning everything upside down. In the past it didn't so much matter, but our modern machine is too delicate. A few more knocks like the Great War, another Luther or two, and the whole concern will go to pieces. In future, the men of reason must see that the madness of the world's maniacs is canalised into proper channels, is made to do useful work like a mountain torrent driving a dynamo." "Making electricity to light a Swiss hotel," said Denis. "You ought to complete the simile." Mr. Scogan waved away the interruption. "There's only one thing to be done," he said. "The men of intelligence must combine, must conspire, and seize power from the imbeciles and maniacs who now direct us. They must found the rational state." The heat that was slowly paralysing all Denis's mental and bodily faculties seemed to bring to Mr. Scogan additional vitality. He talked with an ever-increasing energy, his hands moved in sharp, quick, precise gestures, his eyes shone. Hard, dry and continuous, his voice went on sounding and sounding in Denis's ears with the insistence of mechanical noise. "In the rational state," he heard Mr. Scogan saying, "human beings will be separated out into distinct species, not according to the colour of their eyes or the shape of their skulls, but according to the qualities of their mind and temperament. Examining psychologists, trained to what would now seem an almost superhuman clairvoyance, will test each child that is born and assign it to its proper species. Duly labelled and docketed, the child will be given the education suitable to members of its species, and it will be set in adult life to perform those functions which human beings of his variety are capable of performing." "How many species will there be?" asked Denis. "A great many, no doubt," Mr. Scogan answered. "The classification will be subtle and elaborate, but it is not in the power of a prophet to go into details, nor is it his business. I will do more than indicate the three main species into which the subjects of the rational state will be divided." He paused, cleared his throat, and coughed once or twice, evoking in Denis's mind the vision of a table with a glass and water bottle, and, lying across one corner, a long white pointer for the lantern pictures. "Three main species," Mr. Scogan went on, "will be these: the directing intelligence, the men of faith, and the herd. Among the intelligences will be found all those capable of thought, those who know how to attain a certain degree of freedom, and, alas, how limited, even among the most intelligent, that freedom is from the mental bondage of their time. A select body of intelligences drawn from among those who've turned their attention to the problem of practical life will be the governors of the rational state. They will employ as their instruments of power the second great species of humanity, the men of faith, the madmen, as I've been calling them, who believe in things unreasonably, with passion, and are ready to die for their beliefs and their desires. These wild men, with their fearful potentialities for good or for mischief, will no longer be allowed to react casually to a casual environment. There will be no more Caesar Borgias, no more Luthers and Mohammeds, no more Joanna Southcotts, no more Comstocks. The old-fashioned man of faith and desire, that haphazard creature of brute circumstance, who might drive men to tears and repentance, or who might equally well set them on to cutting one another's throats, will be replaced by a new sort of madman, still externally the same, still bubbling with a seemingly spontaneous enthusiasm, but, how very different from the madman of the past. For the new man of faith will be expending his passion, his desire, and his enthusiasm in the propagation of some reasonable idea. He will be, all unawares, the tool of some superior intelligence." Mr. Scogan chuckled maliciously. It was as though he were taking a revenge, in the name of reason, on enthusiasts. "From their earliest years, as soon, that is, as the examining psychologists have assigned them their place in the classified scheme, the men of faith will have had their special education under the eye of the intelligences. Moulded by a long process of suggestion, they will go out into the world, preaching and practising with a generous mania the coldly reasonable projects of the directors from above. When these projects are accomplished, or when the ideas that were useful a decade ago have ceased to be useful, the intelligences will inspire a new generation of madmen with a new eternal truth. The principal function of the men of faith will be to move and direct the multitude. That third great species consisting of those countless millions who lack intelligence and are without valuable enthusiasm. When any particular effort is required of the herd, when it is thought necessary for the sake of solidarity, that humanity shall be kindled and united by some single enthusiastic desire or idea, the men of faith, primed with some simple and satisfying creed, will be sent out on a mission of evangelization. At ordinary times, when the high spiritual temperature of a crusade would be unhealthy, the men of faith will be quietly and earnestly busy with the great work of education. In the upbringing of the herd, humanity's almost boundless suggestibility will be scientifically exploited. Systematically, from earliest infancy, its members will be assured that there is no happiness to be found except in work and obedience. They will be made to believe that they are happy, that they are tremendously important beings, and that everything they do is noble and significant. For the lower species, the earth will be restored to the centre of the universe, and man to preeminence on the earth. Oh, I envy the lot of the commonality and the regional state, working there 8 hours a day, obeying their betters, convinced of their own grandeur and significance and immortality. They will be marvellously happy, happier than any race of men has ever been. They will go through life in a rosy state of intoxication, from which they will never awake. The men of faith will play the cup-bearers at this lifelong bacchanal, filling and ever filling again with the warm liquor that the intelligences, in sad and sober privacy behind the scenes, will brew for the intoxication of their subjects. "And what will be my place in the rational state?" Denis drowsily inquired from under his shading hand. Mr. Scogan looked at him for a moment in silence. "It's difficult to see where you would fit in," he said at last. "You couldn't do manual work. You're too independent and unsuggestible to belong to the larger herd. You have none of the characteristics required in a man of faith. As for the directing intelligences, they will have to be marvellously clear and mercilessly penetrating." He paused and shook his head. "No, I can see no place for you, only the lethal chamber." Deeply hurt, Denis emitted the imitation of a loud, Homeric laugh. "I'm getting sunstroke here," he said, and got up. Mr. Scogan followed his example, and they walked slowly away down the narrow path, brushing the blue lavender flowers in their passage. Denis pulled a sprig of lavender and sniffed at it, then some dark leaves of rosemary that smelt like incense in a cavernous church. They passed a bed of opium poppies, dispetaled now, the round, ripe seed heads were brown and dry, like Polynesian trophies, Denis thought. Severed heads stuck on poles. He liked the fancy enough to impart it to Mr. Scogan. "Like Polynesian trophies," uttered aloud, the fancy seemed less charming and significant than it did when it first occurred to him. There was a silence, and in a growing wave of sound, the whir of the reaping machines swelled up from the fields beyond the garden and then receded into a remoter hum. "It is satisfactory to think," said Mr. Scogan, as they strolled slowly onward, "that a multitude of people are toiling in the harvest fields in order that we may talk of Polynesia. Like every other good thing in this world, leisure and culture have to be paid for. Fortunately, however, it is not the leisured and the cultured who have to pay. Let us be duly thankful for that, my dear Denis, duly thankful," he repeated, and knocked the ashes out of his pipe. Denis was not listening. He had suddenly remembered Anne. She was with Gombauld, alone with him in his studio. It was an intolerable thought. "Shall we go and pay a call on Gombauld?" he suggested carelessly. "It would be amusing to see what he's doing now." He laughed inwardly to think how furious Gombauld would be when he saw them arriving. End of chapter.